Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It sparked a very deep wave of outrage in the entire Muslim community in France. First of all, because a young teenager was murdered on the day of Arafah, the eve of Eid al-Adha, which is the most observed Muslim religious celebration. Mm. And thirdly, because we all realized that if the events were not caught on camera, everyone basically would have listened to the official version and no one would have realized that actually it wasn't a case of legitimate self-defense, but it was a proper case of brutal murder.
France's estimated 6 million strong Muslims are subject to daily inhuman treatment at the hands of a militant secular state. Islam as a faith has long been traduced and othered, exceptionalized as a religion that must be chastened by French enlightenment. It is in this context that we observe with horror the recent episode of brutality. 17-year-old Nahel Merzouk was killed at point-blank range for a minor traffic infraction. His death, normally another statistic, was caught on camera and led to days of protests and rioting. To help us make sense of this tragic week, I've invited back onto the Thinking Muslim, Rayan Freshi. Rayan is a legal expert and researcher for Cage International, and he has recently authored a disturbing report on the French government's policy of systematic obstruction of the Muslim community. He recently wrote a piece for Middle East Eye analysing these tragic events. Rayan Freshi, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome back to The Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me, okay?
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us and to have you with us in person. It's really a pleasure to be here with you. Now, it's been a tragic week, and we have witnessed some very disturbing scenes on social media and in the broader press. So Rayan, tell me about this brother, 17-year-old Nahel, and his death. The police initially claimed that Nahel was attempting to hit officers with a car. Can you just untangle the reports from the facts of this past week?
Of course, Braglofik Ahi. And so regarding that specific event, what happened is, so Nahel Merzouk is a Arab Muslim teenager, as you mentioned. He's 17 years old, a very good kid, according to every major reports on his background and his life. And he was stopped by the police. It was a very regular traffic stop, something that can happen to anyone, right, at any given moment of the day or the night. And during the traffic stop, unfortunately, the police officers basically lost their mind very quickly. They, out of anxiety and fear, they stopped him quite brutally and quite violently. And even though he did not act in any, he did not act violently in any ways, he did not attempt to their lives in any ways, because he basically feared the reaction of the police officers. At some point, he tried to escape. Mm. So he tried to, he did not turn the engine off, and he tried to move on, despite being stopped and despite two officers having a gun pointed to his head. So he was very scared. Of course, he's a teenager. It's quite understandable that in such a very anxious situation, you don't necessarily behave with rationality. So he tried to escape. And when he tried to escape, the police officer shot him, as you mentioned, at point blank range and murdered him. So what's quite interesting and not surprising at all is the fact that at first, the official version shared by the police was that Nahel basically attempted to threaten their lives, basically. That's what they shared. Mm. What they said is that they had to intervene because it was a case of legitimate self-defense. Mm. To their disarray, the event was filmed. It was caught on camera by a young woman who was there, and she obviously shared the video on social media, and very clearly the video describes what I just described to you. So it's quite obvious that there's no attack by Nahel in any ways. And the moment the video was shared, it clearly proved that the police lied. That's one. Secondly, it sparked a very deep wave of outrage in the entire Muslim community in France. First of all, because a young teenager was murdered. A young teenager was murdered on the day of Arafah, the eve of Eid al-Adha, which is the most observed Muslim religious celebration. Mm. And thirdly, because we all realized that if the events were not caught on camera, everyone basically would have listened to the official version, and no one would have realized that actually it wasn't a case of legitimate self-defense, but it was a proper case of brutal murder.
How often do young Muslims or young men die at the hands of a police?
Well, according to some research, in 2022 alone, one man of African descent died at the hands of the police on a monthly basis.
Wow.
And that's just it's a research. I mean, we don't necessarily have the entire set of data. So it might be even worse than that, actually.
Really?
And if you look at history, if you look at the archives of Muslim militants or militants with an immigrant background in France, one will very clearly realize that from the 70s, and we can actually go back to the colonial era, but if we just start from the 70s onwards, we do not necessarily have, again, official data, but we've seen countless of these racial motivated murders in France. So it's quite it's not unusual at all, unfortunately. What is unusual is to actually have the proof of the injustice, actually. That's what in the end made the difference in that specific case.
So this event sparked a series of protests and even rioting over this past week. Now, before we get to those events that came out of the killing, the murder of Nahel, there is a narrative that's been played out in the media that Nahel had brushes, they call it, with the law. Some say he may have even had criminal activities that were investigated. He didn't have a whiter than white background. Can you shed some light on the past of this teenager?
Yeah. So the first thing that needs to be mentioned is that whatever his background actually is, that does not justify delinquency in any, whatever the degree, does not justify the death at the hands of the police. That's one.
Yeah.
So the very fact that power structures like the state, like medias, try to share these kind of rumors, prove that in their mind, which is quite shocking, if one indulged into some criminal acts in the past, well, maybe his murder is not that bad. It's not that much of an injustice.
Yeah.
So belittling the gravity of a murder because of one's past is a clear proof, I would say, of racism, Islamophobia, whatever the case is, very clearly a form of dehumanization.
Really?
That's one.
Yeah.
Secondly, what's even worse in that case scenario is that actually Brother Nahel, Rahimahullah Ta'ala, he didn't have any criminal record at all.
Mm.
And it's a very, it's factual. It's not something that can be discussed.
Yeah.
He had no criminal record whatsoever. Yeah, he was stopped at times by the police. Very regular traffic stops. Yeah. They're not a criminal transgression whatsoever. So again, these two elements, the fact that they tried to share some dehumanizing rumors, some dehumanizing narratives, plus the fact it's actually, it was all a lie, fueled the anger and the determination, which in the end led to the riots and the uprisings.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. I was saying to you earlier on when we were traveling to our studio today that even I believed that maybe Reverend Nahel had, obviously that's not a justification, but had a dubious past and maybe the police recognized him and so they made some sort of connection. Your argument is that actually zero. I mean, Nahel was a standard, you know, a normal kid, a 17-year-old who happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, how common is it for young men of African descent, of Algerian or Moroccan descent, or Tunisian descent, how regular is it for them to be stopped by the police in these suburbs?
It's extremely common, as it must be reminded that the Muslim neighborhoods, the banlieue, the Muslim suburbs in France are, I'll go into the history of these specific suburbs, but basically they are specifically targeted by the police. So it would be incorrect to define the police function in Muslim neighborhoods as exclusively peacekeeping.
Right.
Or there's more to it. There's a political nature to their function and intervention in these Muslim neighborhoods.
Yes.
It must be reminded that these suburbs are actually the result of specific urban policies by the state and urban policies that were implemented right after the colonization and right after the colonial rule, when most of ex-French colonies achieved independence, there was a wave of Muslim immigrants who went from the colonies and reached France, basically. And as a result of that immigration, the French state implemented some very harsh urban policies, which in the end resulted in a form of segregation. So as a Muslim immigrant, you were in the end forced to live in some specific areas outside of Paris, basically outside of the most populous French cities, but basically Paris at first. And these policies were based on the idea that that population needed to be physically contained from a territorial standpoint to make sure that they did not reach whiter areas, basically, and to make sure that they were then specifically targeted by the police. The idea was to create an atmosphere which fostered criminalization, basically, criminal activities. How do you achieve this? Well, you make sure that, first of all, it's difficult physically to reach Paris, that one. Secondly, you make sure that most of the state institutions do not operate correctly. So the schools, the quality of the schools are obviously not the same as the schools in whiter areas. The very school system in the Muslim suburbs is designed for our community to fail from an educational standpoint. So you fail from an educational standpoint. You do not necessarily have access to jobs. From an economical standpoint, we were and we are still quite poor in there. So no education, no economic solutions, no proper jobs available for an entire community.
Yeah.
Of course, at some point, you still have to find some ways to maintain yourself. And very clearly, we were directed towards a criminal path. Mm-hmm. I'm not here trying to undermine the personal responsibility of any human being who engages into criminal activities, but the idea is that environment matters. And the environment that was established by the French state was an environment which, as I mentioned, very clearly facilitated criminality. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of environment we are still living in France. These very policies were implemented in the 60s and the 70s, and they are still operating nowadays. Even though, I mean, the governance is still the same, even though politicians change, generation changes, but these systemic issues are not addressed at all.
Yeah, so there's a lot written recently about the so-called pressure cooker that was released in this last week, culminating in the most recent protests and riots. How much do you accept that the violence of this past week represents something more than the death, however tragic, of one teenager?
True. I very strongly believe that there are a series of factors that led to that expression of political dissent, which was expressed through violence. Obviously, the death of a young brother on the day of Arafat is obviously a very strong factor. But the stuff that I mentioned priorly, so the different policies implemented in our suburbs, the lack of solutions, the fact that our grievances cannot be expressed, because in the end, it's always about us. It's always the responsibility of, we were talking about criminality, responsibility constantly is constantly placed upon our shoulders, and at no point does anyone tries to address the environment we actually live in and the way the environment was established. The fact that we cannot, as I mentioned, express our grievances, the fact that in France there is a clear intoxicating atmosphere of Islamophobia and racism. Must be reminded here that these two feelings, these two resentments are basically adopted by the entire political spectre in France. Even the far left, in a way or another, indulges into Islamophobia, Islamophobic governance, Islamophobic narratives.
Yeah.
That creates an atmosphere of extreme frustration and anger. So basically, they criticize our way of living on a daily basis. They do not recognize their responsibility in the brutal murders that affect our community. Mm. They do not recognize any responsibility in the systemic injustices they've established because of their bigotry. And these issues have been part of the picture, of the French picture, for decades now. Well, at some point, of course, if you don't have any ways, any peaceful ways to express your dissent, your grievances, well, you're still going to express them. Mm-hmm. It's just that you're going to use violence, because that's the only route available. That's the only tool that is left, available tool that is left to us.
And we must make it clear, because I can imagine after today's interview, I'm going to get reams of comments left by French people and others to say that your guest is justifying the rioting, the destruction of private property. You said in a recent article, in your recent piece in the Middle East Eye, that this was the natural, the logical consequence of years of marginalization. Are you justifying criminality here?
I'm not justifying criminality. I'm trying to explain it. I'm trying to understand the causes, the causal pathway that led to violence.
Yeah.
Violence occurred.
Yeah.
And there are two trends in here.
Yeah.
We either believe that Muslims, because they are Muslims, they are inherently barbaric, And the only thing they know is violence. And they are constantly going to use that specific tool because they are Muslims and that's the end of it. Mm. Or we can try not to be Islamophobic, racist, and bigot and try to understand things without a dehumanizing frame and trying to understand things without necessarily justifying them, but just understanding them. Mm. From a purely human perspective, there's a Sufi Sheikh from Morocco who used to say that one must make the difference between the spiritual and the human. Certain things are just going to happen because it's a human thing. Mm. If you do not allow a community, if you don't let them express their ideas, if you don't let them express their legitimate grievances, if you, on the other hand, constantly curtail their fundamental rights, if you constantly dehumanize them, if you constantly criminalize their way of life, a way of life which is Islam, which has been around in the last 14 centuries. Mm-hmm. Well, at some point, for sure, it's going to fuel anger. And anger as a feeling, as a human feeling, leads to violence. Mm-hmm. That's not specific to Muslims. Mm-hmm. It's human.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting, Baron. And I can see a paradox here because, of course, the French argue that they believe fundamentally in equality. And they believe in treating everyone the same. And ultimately, what they require from migrants, from Muslims, from others, is to assimilate into French society. But of course, this policy of ghettoizing, if that's the right term to use, ghettoizing them into the banlieue, into the suburbs, Nanterre, which is the place where Nahel came from, the municipality where Nahel came from, was part of this sprawling suburb. If you marginalize people, then surely you're not going to get the desired effect of assimilation. How do French politicians reconcile what seems to be pretty irreconcilable?
Yeah, it is indeed. And I think that what must be unveiled in here is that even though the official narrative is the assimilation one, the idea that because you live in France, at some point you need to adopt French values, whatever they are. Mm. Can be basically what we can identify here is basically engage in a more liberal way of life, maybe something that is more influenced by modernism and secularization as well, that kind of stuff. But it's very clear that it's still that the French identity is still ethnocentric.
Right.
So you might leave, in other words, the fold of Islam, mm-hmm. or totally cut yourself from your spiritual heritage as a North African, as a Muslim, or someone with some Muslim background. Mm. You cannot change your ethnicity. Mm. We haven't invented a pathway which could reform that. So even though you might totally cut yourself from your spiritual lineage and adopt another deen, you will still remain ethnically different. And because of that difference, which is a natural one, which is a physical one, you will never be part of the victorious group of the French, basically. Yeah. So there's it's a paradox, but I believe it's a construction which is meant to attract us and make sure that we could leave the fold of Islam, or at the very least, leave the more political aspects of our deen, which could in the end result in some political change, of course, in France.
Right. Now, of course, there is a bigger problem here, and you intimate that in some of your answers, the systematic marginalization of the Muslim community in France. Now, you've said previously on a program I recorded with you that there is a policy of systematic obstruction in France. Can you explain this policy to us?
Of course. It's an official policy that was implemented by Macron in February 2018. It's still operating as we speak. Mm. And the overarching spirit of that policy is basically to use any piece of legislation, any relevant piece of legislation, which could systematically obstruct the expressions of Muslimness, but also the, I would say, the political growth of the Muslim community. Mm. So that concretely materializes in, for example, the constant harassment by the state of Muslim businesses,
right.
Muslim schools, Muslim mosques, of course, Muslim organizations. And by harassment, I mean either the closure of these institutions, of these Muslim-led establishments, or the, at the very least, control, investigation of these establishments. Mm. Since February 2018, we're basically talking about 28,000 Muslim establishments being controlled, investigated by the state.
Wow.
We're talking about more than 900 of those establishments being closed down. So as I mentioned, businesses, mosques, Islamic schools, Muslim organizations. We're also talking about more than, I think it's around 55 million euros seized by the state from the Muslim community, of course. So one of the most spectacular cases were the dissolutions of, by the government, huh? Dissolutions by the government of a very famous Muslim human rights group, the CCIF.
Mm-hmm.
So one could argue, well, the CIF, it's a human rights group, it's led by Muslims, so there might be some political nature which in the end resulted into the dissolution. Well, actually, they also dissolved a humanitarian NGO, a Muslim humanitarian NGO, Baraka City. They also closed down a Muslim publishing house. The Land of Literature closed down an organization, a publishing house, whose job was to publish very classical Islamic books of the Islamic corpus.
But was this publishing house, I don't know, publishing Sayyid Qutb books? Or
not even that, Very basic books on Aqidah by, for example, Ibn Taymiyyah. They were publishing books on spirituality, on the idea of ghuraba, being strangers from a spiritual standpoint.
Mm.
There were some political books as well, but nothing that very clearly incited to, I don't know, violence, daily violence or anything of that nature.
So let me get this straight, because I think what you're suggesting here is pretty profound. So the French state has a policy, systematic obstruction, that goes after Muslim civic life. It finds any means, any law. So it could be number of laws they could utilize to close down masajid, to close down businesses, to close down organizations, to take money from or freeze money in bank accounts. I think you said 55. Million has been frozen of Muslim money. 900 organizations have been shut down.
Yeah.
But you know where's the law here? Where does the law apply? You know, surely there is the French system of France. It believes in the rule of law. How do they reconcile this with French legal precepts?
I would explain this by basically describing a feature of the law in and of itself, and then of the French legislation. First of all, too often we describe legislation in the West as being a neutral tool, even though it's quite paradox, because the first function of the parliament, which is a political institution, is to legislate, is to actually adopt and enact some laws. So the law is never neutral. It's the result of a political will. That's one. So it's not neutral. And even though, as you mentioned, there are some basic pillars, some basic tenets to the rule of law, even in France, it must be understood that the law in and of itself can still be discriminatory. It can still be used to target some specific groups because we believe that these groups need to be targeted or addressed specifically. And that's what's happening in France. For example, if we put on the side the systematic obstruction for a second. In France, the Islamophobic governance was able to enact a law in 2004, which bans hijab from public schools. There also is a law enacted in 2010, which totally bans niqab. It's totally prohibited in France to wear niqab. It's one of the few places in the world where such a prohibition actually exists. The reason why I'm mentioning these laws is because very clearly they target one specific community. Yeah. It's not, it doesn't address a common practice. It's something that only Muslims do because we are Muslim, because of our faith and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So the French legislation is very clearly discriminatory, and that's why I'm talking about Islamophobic governance. I believe that in France, Muslims are governed in a specific way, meaning that there are a specific set of policies, the systematic obstruction, a specific set of legislation, of laws, which are exclusively applied to us.
They were designed for Muslims.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's chilling, really. Let's go back to that, the legislation that banned the hijab in 2005, did you say?
2004.
And the banning of niqab. How did they, like intellectually, how do they justify this? Because a lot of our viewers would say, well, surely these societies believe in equality, they believe in religious tolerance, they believe in freedom. How do you justify the banning of a religious practice, which doesn't look particularly problematic? It's, you know, peaceful. It seems pretty inert. I mean, how do they justify this according to their own liberal thinking?
Yeah, it's justified by the way the French regard secularism.
Uh-huh. So in this is laicité.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So even the word is not the same.
Yeah.
The concept is slightly different.
Right.
It basically, it's based on the idea, laïcité, that religion and religious beliefs should not influence the social sphere at large. Mm-hmm. Of course, they should not, according to them, influence governance. And it's a result of a centuries-long struggle between republicans and monarchists in the 19th century. Monarchists being Catholics who believed that religion should have a say in the way politics were run, and Republicans actually believe in a very strong and harsh form of secularism. Basically, the idea that no amount of religious feelings should influence not only governance but also the social sphere, as according to them, if religion starts to influence the social sphere, then at some point it's going to influence politics and governance.
By social sphere, you mean?
Public square.
Schools and universities.
Right. Whatever.
So in a school or a university, for example, you wouldn't have prayer facilities for Muslims?
It's very hard to find such a thing in France.
Yeah.
It's extremely hard to find some of these spaces.
Yeah.
Most of the time they do not exist. That does not mean that there's a legislation which bans like prayer in universities. Mm. It's just that authorities in their academic authorities are not going to regard this with the right eye. They're not going to allow Muslims to, I don't know, rent a room, but just have a specific room where they can pray. They won't allow that kind of stuff. And the reason why they don't do this is because of a secular culture based on laïcité, basically. And it's also, I believe, the result of a wider securitization process and criminalization of our community and our beliefs as a result of the war on terror. Of course, the war on terror influenced the French culture and the French governance as well. But there's even more. The war on terror found a very fertile ground in France as must be reminded that France engaged in a very brutal war against Algerians in the 60s, and obviously they were Muslims, they were struggling for their independence. So political violence enacted by Muslims has always been part of the French picture, and I would say of the French psyche. So in the French psyche, Muslims, especially when they're expressing their faith, especially when they're expressing basic forms of Muslimness or just expressing political ideas, political grievances, it's instantaneously regarded as something that could lead to a deep conflict, like the conflict which occurred in the 60s. So that's, I think, one of the psychological reasons why there is a lot of anticipatory anxiety and deep fear over any expression of Muslimness in France.
I want to understand a very recent piece of legislation. I think in 2021, the government passed into law the anti-separatism law, which became an issue around the world. And I think it's the first time that Muslims and non-Muslims around the world began to sort of see how overt this marginalization of Muslims and Islam was in France. And it's a chilling piece of legislation that gives unprecedented powers to the state to disrupt Muslim civic life. Now, I suppose, why did they need an additional piece of legislation where they already had, since 2018, the government, the executive policy of systematic obstruction? And if you can give us just the highlights of what the anti-separatism bill aims to achieve, please.
The overarching spirit of that legislation is to facilitate even more the systematic obstruction policy. The idea is that...
to make it easier.
Exactly. To make sure that it can achieve even, I was about to say better or worse results, actually. That's the overarching spirit. And that's not just my personal analysis. Yeah. It's I'm here quoting some official documents drafted by the very government, which explained that the official goal of the anti-separatism law was to enhance the systematic obstruction policy. As you mentioned, it's a bill which contains, I think, 103 different reforms, so it's quite large. And the reason why it was adopted in 2021, so a year after the presidential election of in 2022. And most of the French Islamophobic laws are adopted in order to recruit, in order to attract part of the far-right electorate.
Right.
In the last 20 years, there's been a massive push of far-right policies and of far-right parties. We went from a party which basically, I'm talking about the far-right, which basically attracted something around 10-15% of the electorate to a, not even one party, but a series of far-right parties, which in the end have become nowadays majoritarian. So, in order for any centrist party, in order for any leftist party, in order for it to basically win elections and make sure that they keep some kind of advantage, they need to adopt part of the far-right narratives and hence part of the far-right policies or suggested pieces of legislation. That's the political picture is the main reason why, with the, of course, culture, the philosophy behind it that I mentioned earlier, is one of the key reasons why these pieces of legislation are adopted in France. In the last 20 years, each and every presidential term witnessed its own Islamophobic piece of legislation. So it's a trend actually in France. It's not unusual at all. We know that every 4 or 5 years something is going to be adopted, and I mean a piece of legislation, which is going to specifically target Muslims and forms of Muslimness.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I read the draft bill and it suggested that a passport of some sort would be put together, would be assigned to every child so that a child could not be removed from the state education system. It becomes impossible or very difficult now to teach your children at home. You have to send them to a state school. Did that provision remain in the final piece of legislation?
Yeah, it's still there. Yeah. And one of the key ideas was to, as I mentioned, it's part of the assimilation process. It's part of the idea that at some point Muslims, if we want to pacify them, we must make sure that their religiosity weakens. Then we need to make sure that they do not send their children in Islamic schools. But they would, of course, force them into Islamophobic secular system, basically, educational system.
So you can't homeschool children.
It's impossible. At the very least, you can't do that invoking a religious, political, or philosophical reason. That was the case prior to that. Nowadays, it's not officially banned, but basically what they did is that they restrained it so much that it's impossible for us to engage in that specific educational path. What they say is that, you can homeschool your child if, for example, he is severely handicapped, or if he engages in a sports career or in an artistic specific endeavor. If you don't fall into these three very restrictive categories, basically, you cannot homeschool your child.
So you previously talked about this policy of forcible assimilation. And we've discussed the paradox of ghettoizing Muslims and how that, you know, creates more antagonism. And that's what partly led to these riots and protests in this past week. So let me try to understand, what is the ideal situation for the French state? What does the French state want to achieve ideally in the Muslim community? Like, what concessions do they want to solicit from Muslims?
That's very interesting. An intriguing question. I would say that according to them, in reality, despite the official discourse and the official narrative, it would be an established ghettoization, as it is the case right now, something that would remain in place, and a Muslim population, which do not express any kind of political grievance or political idea, especially when these ideas or these grievances find their root in the Islamic faith. Yeah. It's basically the ideal situation is a totally dehumanizing view. It's the idea that we should accept unfair policies. We should accept being invisible, basically. Because that's, in the end, the only way they can properly accept our presence, which is in and of itself a paradox. Our presence must be invisible. That's the only way they can accept that. Because the root cause, I think, of this worldview in the end is the idea that as Muslims, as non-whites, we are not equal to them. And especially, I'm here mentioning the religious criteria, because especially in France, even though, as I mentioned, it's an ethnocentric view and it's based on an ethnicity, it's also based on the idea that at some point, if you are properly human and intelligent enough, you should recognize that the French way of life, universalism, enlightenment, the ideas that were spread by enlightenment are the best for mankind, and hence you should at some point either leave the worldview of your forefathers, especially if that worldview is spiritual, and at the very least, if you don't want to totally cut ties with that heritage, you should reform it based on the enlightenment model. So it's either it's a form of supremacy. I believe that white supremacy in France has a specific feature, and that's we can call that, I guess, it's an expression that is quite new. So I know you won't find that anywhere else. That it's still, that might be some gaps, but I would call that Republican supremacy. Republic is obviously the form of governance in France.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea that the Republic as a form of governance and with a set of values and ideas, which are not necessarily quite clear, in the end are still superior, inherently superior to anything else, and more specifically, superior to Islam.
Macron suggests that Islam is a religion in crisis. And do you believe that the government is trying to create intense fear within the Muslim community so that Muslims either have these choices, either they assimilate or they remain subdued in their suburbs? Like, is this in effect the intent of the French government?
Yeah, I believe that, and that's not just my understanding, it's something that was expressed by the Ministry of the Interior, Gérald Darmanin, a few years ago, when he said, we are spreading terror. He was talking about a systematic obstruction policy and the implementation of
the anti-Semitism. He called it terror.
Terror. He used that specific term. He said, we are beginning to spread terror in the basically in the Muslim community. So I think there are a lot of similarities with the American context. Obviously, it's not the same, but there are some similarities. And I'm very influenced by the writings of a Black Panther thinker, Thuruba bin Wahab, where he mentions in one of his articles, he says, white America is terrified by the idea of Black-white equality, because that would mean that Blacks could defend themselves from a physical standpoint and at some point basically achieve political growth and political power. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a lot of similarities with the French context. Indeed, the French are, I strongly believe it's part of their psyche. It might sound essentializing, but khair inshallah. I believe that their psyche is very much influenced by the colonization and the brutal wars of independence, basically. And they lost those wars. And now the grandchildren of those who were illiterate with not a lot of military or physical means, yet still won the war against them, their grandchildren live in France. We are maybe something around 8 or 10 million Muslims in France. We don't know with precision because ethnic and religious stats are banned in France. You can't actually collect and gather that data.
I need to understand. I need to understand. So you're not allowed, the government is not allowed to collect statistics. So we have a census here every 10 years. And, you know, since 2001 in the UK, we've had a religious box that you tick, you know, which religion you belong to. Are you saying that's illegal? That's banned in France?
Yeah, that's illegal.
But why? I mean, that makes very little sense.
It's illegal because you're mentioning equality, and according to them, as everyone is equal, there's no reason why we should collect that kind of data,
right?
And which is obviously a fallacy. And it's also based on the idea that the French, in order to pursue the assimilation process, they refuse to recognize the official existence of minorities on French soil. Even in the public discourse, the word minority is not used a lot, not as much as in the UK context or the American context, because it's not recognized by the French state. Even from a constitutional standpoint, where they will argue that as France recognizes the principle of equality and opposes discrimination, there's no point in recognizing minorities. There are no minorities because we are all equal.
Do the French really believe that? Like, when they see events like this, 2005, 2023, you see enormous outpouring of emotion at the death of yet another teenager at the hands of a racialized police force. don't the French step back and say, well, maybe we've got it wrong. Maybe we do have a society which is deeply unequal, and maybe we need to find other ways to deal with this very perturbing situation. Doesn't that discussion take place in France?
Not at all, wow. Even though it's obviously part of their psyche. They obviously know that this inequality exists and what they're doing is totally unfair, of course. But I think it's connected to the fear factor that I mentioned earlier. Mm. The idea that if we start recognizing their existence, if we do not apply extremely brutal and harsh Islamophobic, dehumanizing policies, well, that means that at some point their expression is going to become political. And if the expression is political, it might lead to political growth, the political growth of the Muslim community. Wow. And in their mind, that growth equals with defeat, with military conflict, which in the end leads to defeat and decline. Mm. And nowadays, very clearly, it sounds very psychological, but I believe psychology is the underlying science of political science. It's always in there, and the best political scientists, the best scholars, they always have a very deep and precise mastery of psychology and social psychology. It would require another podcast, I guess, but basically, very clearly, there is a common sense in France that the country is not as powerful as it were in the past.
Right.
France is not the third superpower, and then the rest of the world, but we're just so powerful that in the end, we can enact any policy, we can choose any kind of foreign policy, it's not going to change much. We're totally independent.
Right.
Well, we are living in a different context right now. We're seeing the rise of a multipolar world. We're seeing countries which in the past were extremely structurally dependent over the West. We're seeing countries which are slowly moving towards concrete forms of independence. I think that for them, realizing that there's some competition coming from countries which were totally subdued to them in the past, realizing that some of these countries are Muslim, realizing that their economic power is not as clear and established as it was in the past, realizing that internally speaking, they are facing economical crisis after another, and they don't necessarily find solutions, structural solutions to them, it clearly inspires a sense of decline. Except that on top of that, according to them, you have between 8 and 10 million Muslims in the country. And despite the overwhelming Islamophobia and policies, they still find ways to express themselves. So that means there's still there's a willingness to power. There's a willingness to still overcome their injustice. And that feeling is something that must be very scary for them, because if a slave accepts to be a slave, that's fine. You don't have to do anything. You're good. But if the slave starts to realize that actually he shouldn't be a slave, there's no reason why he should be, and it's actually more interesting to be a master, then you might have a problem. And I think that this is the, in a very, I realize that even my wording is quite, can be quite generic and prosaic, but I still feel that it basically describes the overall psychological tendency in France at the moment.
And how much does this collective psychology play into the rise of the far right in France? And should Muslims be more perturbed by Marine Le Pen and National Front than, say, Macron?
I think that's the most important factor, the most important reason why the far right is basically gathering so much support. That's one. Secondly, of course, for sure, a governance led by Le Pen might be slightly harsher for us than Macron. Mm. But what's essential here is that the question in and of itself, I believe, is not the right one, because asking this question leads us to make a choice and implies that there's a clear difference between a Macron, a centrist kind of governance, and a governance led by the far right. Mm-hmm. And implying this undermines the idea and the clear trend that we've witnessed in the last 20 years that far-right ideas and policies following the Overton window and the Overton process became mainstream and are now a clear part of Macron's party discourse, narratives, and policies. So 25 years earlier, even a right-wing party would have never thought about establishing the systematic obstruction policy or adopting the anti-separatism law. That policy and that legislation was not adopted by Le Pen. It was implemented and adopted by Macron. Uh-huh. So that's, to me, the question is still relevant, but I believe that the main thing in here is to understand that the far-right ideas, narratives, overall discourse is spreading. And that's the issue, not the eventual difference, which exists, of course, between Macron and Le Pen. Because even Macron does not act like Le Pen today, he's going to act like Le Pen in 5 years.
And is that spreading beyond? Macron is a centrist. He's a neoliberal. You know, he is seen by many in the world as being a moderate force, you know, in French politics. And I think you've dispelled that myth today. But what about the left, the socialists, the Labour contingent? Is it Jean-Luc Mélenchon? Sorry if I pronounced that wrong. You know, are there sympathetic voices in the left in France?
There's a beautiful expression coined by a friend of mine. He says Mélenchon is a pro-Muslim Islamophobe.
Pro-Muslim Islamophobe.
He's basically looking for our votes, but he's still an Islamophobe, meaning that he supports most of the Islamophobic governments that I mentioned, the ban on hijab in 2004, the ban on niqab. He regards, from a philosophical standpoint, religion as being backwards, as being a barbaric way of life, which in the end, at some point, must be abandoned. Mm. So he needs our votes, but he still remains an Islamophobe. Imagine that in 2010, when the niqab law was enacted, prior to any law being adopted, a parliamentary commission is set up, and they discuss about the issue, quote unquote issue, and then they write a report which is used as the, let's say, model for the future law. That commission was headed, I'm talking about the commission of the anti-niqab law, was headed by a communist.
A communist
in France. Yes. So the left and the far left have a strong history, even if back to the colonial era. They always, in a way or another, maybe not in an overt way, but very passively or implicitly supported Islamophobic governance. And that's why we can't expect anything from them. Just to give you, for example, a little secret of anti-police brutality advocacy, most of these groups have been, I'm talking about grassroots militants, have been in a way or another co-opted by the left and the far left. And in order to be co-opted, in order to be supported by these parties, they had to abandon the anti-Islamophobia struggle. What they need to mention when they're talking about police brutality is that it's a racial issue, but there's nothing Islamophobic about that, even though most of the victims of police brutality are Muslims. Whatever the level of their religiosity is, they are Muslims. And secondly, we're living the war on terror. The main suspect nowadays is not identified through a ethnic or racial lens. It's always there, but the main criteria is Islam. Nael is Muslim, was Muslim, rahimahullah, whatever the level of religiosity. 2 weeks prior to his death, another Muslim, a teenager, was killed, was murdered by the police again during a traffic stop. He was black, Al Hussein, he was Muslim. So the main criteria in here remains the deen. That's, we could go into a more philosophical discussion, and denying the fact that the deen is the criteria which structures the political discourse and the overall political conflict would actually mean that the opposition between truth and falsehood is not relevant, which is absurd. So the criteria is this one, but going back to the left and the far left, they co-opted some of our struggles, and the cost was to constantly remove the anti-Islamophobia advocacy.
Let's return back to the motivations of the police. I've noticed there's a debate about whether there are parallels that can be drawn between policing in the United States and policing in France. And there are voices that suggest that you may have some rogue actors, some bad apples in the police force, but there's not a systematic racial profiling or Islamophobia that exists within the police. From your perspective, is Islamophobia and racism systemic within the police force?
Yeah, it is. It is. And there are a series of reasons why I believe the issues that we are trying to address are systemic. First of all, it must be, we were talking about that earlier. What is the actual function of, let's say, the police? We could actually apply the same reasoning to any French institution, but let's just focus on the police.
Yeah.
What is the police doing in Muslim suburbs? Is it just about making sure that peace and public order are being protected? Or is it something more? If one looks at history, for example, police during the colonial era, its function was to subdue Muslim indigenous population to the Republic's rule. It's not just about peacekeeping. It's about making sure that from a political standpoint, an entire population totally submits to our rule and do not try to seek independence, autonomy. Now, police nowadays inherited that same function just in another context. We were talking about ghettoization. So if we want to make sure that this population remains invisible, does not grow politically speaking, well, you're sending the police, and on top of that, you fear, psychologically, you fear their growth. You're sending the arm, the violent arm of the state in those places to make sure that they remain invisible, that they will remain in these suburbs, that they will be directed towards the criminal system, that they, the justice system, basically, and that you can properly obstruct their political growth. That's the function. It's not written in any official document, but that doesn't mean it's not there. That's the way they act. Police brutality does not happen in white areas. Why is that? It occurs in Muslim suburbs. And there's a political reason why. It's not just about some, of course, some police officers might be terrified of addressing Muslims because of the overall Islamophobic atmosphere that we described earlier. But the idea, and they know that very, even if they can't express it, it's part of their psyche as well. They must make sure that this Muslim population, which in the end is a threat to our rule, must be subdued. And that's why they act in a very violent way. And if one doesn't believe me, because I'm a bearded crazy guy of Algerian descent who has a problem with the French.
From Cage.
Well, from Cage on top of that, which, yes. Don't listen to me. But there's an official data which no one can deny. which proved that more than 50% of police officers in France support far-right parties. More than 50%. So this is why there's no reforming such an institution. You don't... First of all, the official function that I mentioned is clearly Islamophobic and racist. That's one. And that's the most problematic issue we're tackling. Now, on top of that, you have, you're addressing police officers that are clearly Islamophobic and racist. How do you solve that? Are you going to show them a video or a movie telling them that, no, actually, Islam is goodness and Muslims are good people because they respect the rights of their neighbor, and then poof, Islamophobia and racism are just going to disappear? I think it's quite delusional. So the only solution is the total abolition of such an institution, which in the end has been established and operates with the intent of curtailing our fundamental rights, stealing our lives, or at the very least, stealing our lives, basically, and for sure, obstructing our political growth.
Rehan, some of my viewers may be watching and listening to your comments with horror, but they may argue that, well, maybe the reason why Muslims are so marginalized is that they haven't joined the political process. They haven't achieved political success. They haven't voted as a bloc for particular candidates so that they can create a critical mass, maybe, in a parliament. So then they have to be listened to. I mean, it's a superficial analogy, and there are lots of poor things we can say about, very destructive things we can say about someone like Sadiq Khan in London.
True.
And the types of activities he gets involved in and how that misrepresents what Islam is about.
True.
But at the very least, you know, he is characterized as a practicing Muslim. He fasts in Ramadan. You know, he prays his salah. He goes to Salat al-Jummah. And so from one perspective, Muslims have some level of safety there where they've got a politician who's willing to, at the very least, fight their corner. Okay, one can query, where has he actually done that?
Of course.
But at least symbolically, he's there.
True.
How would you respond to that? That, you know, your basic problem in France, or the problem of the Muslim community, is that they're too apolitical and they're not involved in the political process.
I would say that the reason why we were not able to achieve such a success is also because of the very harsh environment we live in. Mm. So I would not say that we are necessarily all quietists or apolitical. I think that we were not able, up until now, to properly organize, politically speaking, in order to project some influence. That's for sure. Yeah. And I guess it would require yet another podcast on, because there are a series of factors. Obviously, we have some responsibility, that's for sure. But it's just some of our, let's say, political failures are also quite were predictable, because any community goes through a specific process and a maturation process, basically. So you do some things, you try some things, and they fail, but you learn from that.
Yeah.
For sure, we were not able to project that influence. We also live in a very tough, as I mentioned, environment where our political expression is constantly asphyxiated. So it's very hard for us to find avenues of for expression, basically.
Are there any Muslims who have made it to, you know, the political system?
Locally speaking, at times some mayors in some of these suburbs are Muslims.
Yeah.
But on a larger scale, some cultural Muslims maybe at times, but very clearly when they made it, they never identified properly as practicing Muslims. At times they didn't even identify as Muslims or even cultural Muslims at all.
Yeah.
At once, it happened with during Sarkozy's rule. So back in 2007, Sarkozy was a president, a right-wing president. Mm. And he was the one who led the opposition to the 2005 riots and uprisings.
He called them scum.
Scum, exactly,
yeah,
scum.
Yeah.
And in order to, basically, it was quite a clever political move, from a moral standpoint, you'll soon realize that it's quite disgusting. But what he did is that he appointed some cultural Muslims in some actual, as ministers, basically. When I say cultural Muslims, I will not share the name of one minister who said back in the days, she actually said, oh yeah, I'm Muslim, but I attend, how do you call it, the mass in every Sunday.
Mass
every Sunday.
Brilliant.
I was like, okay, that's quite interesting form of Muslimness. But yes. That's the kind of profiles he appointed.
Yeah. It seems to me that you in France, the Muslim community in France, are living through a very repressive period. And it doesn't seem there's a positive end in sight. I mean, if all of the political parties support this extreme Islamophobia, is there a discussion in France amongst Muslims that maybe we've made a mistake, or maybe we need to move on? We need to leave France and we need to make hijra to a Muslim country. I mean, you are from Algerian descent. Is there a discussion amongst the Algerians that maybe it's time to return back to our country of our forefathers?
Of course. Very clearly, France, the next step in terms of persecution after France is basically India.
Wow.
India, China, Egypt. We're not there yet, but we're not there yet, right? So, but that's the next step, that's for sure,
yeah.
If we don't do anything about it. The discussions regarding hijrah are quite widespread amongst the community, and it's not just about discussions. We don't have any data, but there's a significant amount of Muslims who already left France. They went to Turkey, they went back to Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, which was totally unthinkable 2 decades ago, because these countries are facing lots of structural issues, of course, and it was totally unthinkable to go back to, for example, Algeria. They left for Turkey, the UAE, Canada, and so on and so forth, the UK, of course. So it's already happening. Now, I would argue that I'm Muslim. So when a form of persecution takes place, there is indeed a khair, a form of goodness. It's happening because Allah Azza wa Jalla wants that to happen. It's actually a sunnah. Islamophobia in and of itself is a sunnah. It's not something that is going to disappear at some point because Sadiq Khan became mayor or whatever. It's always going to be there. It's always going to be a clear opposition to truth. That's what we were mentioning earlier. It's just the way Allah Azza wa Jalla wanted that. So Islamophobia is always going to take place. And when a community is facing severe forms of persecution, it's going to lead to two kind of behaviors. You either flee the persecution, you leave, or if you stay and you endure it and you're patient, but not in a quietest way. You're patient meaning you are steadfast. It's also building your character and your willingness. If you survive that, well, you will for sure reinvigorate your religiosity, your spirituality, and for sure, reinvigorating this does not just mean that you're not going to abandon Salah or abandon fasting. You're going to do that, and you're also going to reform the place you live in. You're going to, in other words, engage in a political endeavor in order to seize power. We don't seize power because we necessarily enjoy power. Some of us do, of course. But the idea, the spirit is that we believe that the only legitimate and fair authority and governance is Islam. We are bringing this because it's good. It's good for human beings. Mm. So if you look at the, it's obviously not an analogy, but it's just to make a point. The Sahaba conquered the world also because most of them went through the harness, the harshness, the persecution in Mecca. That's what built their structure. That's what built their psychology. That's what built their spirituality. When you go through torture and you survive that, most of the time you don't necessarily become quietist. And I'm not implying that you become blindly violent. Mm. You just don't want that to happen anymore. So you're going to make sure that you establish a rule, a governance, call it the way you want to, something that is fair and where persecution against yourself, but also against others, does not happen. So it's a mixed bag. We could also be crushed because of the persecution. We don't always win, that's for sure. But if we remain steadfast, if we are able to properly organize, if we are able to keep a clear political vision, we're trying to grow politically, we're trying to bring goodness, Islam, goodness to France, even France. There's so much conflict in me. I want to bring goodness to them. But yeah, that's actually the idea. Mm. And if we manage to do that, we can be successful. It's a tremendously difficult political endeavor, of course. There are so many challenges. How do you properly organize? How do you properly translate the energy of these young rioters into a political dedication which could lead to Islamic rule? It's not easy. It's not going to happen overnight. But that's the challenge, and that's the pathway, inshallah, we're going to engage in. And if we are successful in this life and we properly achieve political success, alhamdulillah. If we don't, anyways, we tried and we're going to be successful in the akhirah. So,
and finally, Rayan, if Allah gives you life in 5 years' time, do you see yourself remaining in France or do you see yourself moving away?
You asked me that question last year.
And I want to see if your answer is different.
It's different or not.
Yes.
So I went through the persecution. And now, basically, only Allah Azrael knows. I really don't know. Really, I don't know for sure. But even if one wants to make hijrah, I mean, that's fine. But hijrah, the spirit of hijrah is not to leave and just live your life and you're totally disconnected from the rest of the ummah. I'm just, you know, I'm praying, I'm fasting.
Become a nomad.
Yeah, that's not the idea. Yeah. Why did the Prophet ﷺ made hijrah? He built Medina. Why? To conquer Mecca. Mm-hmm. There's always a political endeavor behind hijrah. It's not a neutral act. So, so whatever the case, I guess I'll forever be a problem for France, even if I'm not in France. I'm doing this this podcast in London, and I'm still opposing them. So I guess hopefully Azrael keeps that in me, not because I have something against the French in and of themselves, hopefully, but because you just oppose injustice and kufr and what's not good for mankind, basically. So whether I'm here or somewhere else, I hope that that spirit will still remain in me. And if that's not the case, you won't have to invite me anymore.
Well, inshallah, we hope to invite you many more times again, Rayan Peskid. Jazakallah khair for your time today. Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkinmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.